nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Start talking about what actually occurs at the interface in a battery. In my personal opinion, what occurs at that interface is the heart of the battery. Without what occurs there, this is just a diffusion problem or just a resistive system, right? Without the interfacial reactions occurring at the interface, then you would just simply have a system where just mass diffuses through. You wouldn't have the reaction zone or even the possibility of a reaction zone. So just to build up on one of the questions that were asked on the previous class, can't remember who was asking. I think you were asking me about the charge of the interface, right? So just to start from there, to detail that question, I think we just discussed it very briefly and then we moved on, right? So think of this, what you have on this side as a particle of active material, right? Basically what you have there, it's a charged surface, okay? The particle exposed in the electrolyte is really imposing a potential, an electrical field to its surroundings. Okay, and as a result of that, you can think of the particle being positively charged. Okay, and in the background here, you have an electrolyte. As a first approximation, imagine that that liquid to be uniform in the sense that everything is perfectly well mixed. Okay, so here in the back, you have positive and negative charges floating around. So if you go on and resort to your classic electrostatics, if you have a charged surface and you have this ionic liquid, right, where you have positive and negative charges equally floating around, basically moving around through Brownian motion, right, basically motion in this case in the liquid media right now, no potential imposed on it, you just basically seed your electrolyte with these charges. So here you have something that is thermally driven in the sense that the thermal energy allows for these atomic charges to just basically moving around through diffusion, right? But if a charge encounters another charge of the same polarity, it will try to repel each other, right? Until it's far away that basically doesn't seem that force. Strictly speaking, it would have to be infinitely far away, right? But in this case, because say this charge, for example, could be surrounded by positive charges because charges of opposite sign will attract, then it doesn't take many charges for this negative charge to not be able to see that other negative charge over there, for example. Okay? So, but this particle over here is effectively charged. So you would expect that if I specify a concentration C naught, an initial concentration C naught of negative charges and a concentration C naught plus of positive charges, so that effectively the overall charge of the electrolyte is neutral, okay, meaning that the electrolyte itself is not charged, okay, but that you have positive and negative ions, is the equivalent of having water and basically mixing some salt on it, right? The sodium ions and the chlorine ions will dissociate and will be just basically be part of the solution, basically mixed at the atomic level, right? But mixed and ionized in the system, right? So if you have this positive charge here, what will happen is that these ions, the negative ions, are going to feel attracted to that. So soon after you immerse this particle in the electrolyte, you should develop immediately, right, a negative surface charge on it, right? And as a result of that, well, and you will get as many charges, right, trying to accumulate in this pile up on the surface just to try to balance out this charge, right? So if this is highly charged, right, if these are really large charges, then you should expect to have a lot of them. And how many will you have here? Well, it will be enough until far, far away, right, you can see of this that charged surface to basically be electrically neutralized by all these charges that come and try to match it, right? Tend to balance themselves out, right? And of course, these charges are repelling each other, but they feel more the attraction to that one, so they just keep coming in. Okay? Now, a charge, a positive charge that is sitting over here, will see indeed this charge and feel repelled to it, but depending on how many charges you have here, it'll also feel attracted to this charge, right? So it shouldn't be surprised if later on you also have charges like this. Right, and of course here I am thinking of basically you're developing this multiple layers of ordering, right, of different charges that develop, right? You could have different layers that form on top of it. So I guess if you were, you can think of many thought experiments, right, where you have from the negative charge that deposits there, then a positive charge deposits, and then another negative charge, always trying to balance it out. It doesn't really happen that way in its entirety. What you would expect is because this system is thermally driven, there is some noise, right, associated with that. These charges are actually moving. So as you get away from the surface, basically you get more positive and negative charge ratio. Basically the far field, the field imposed by this particle will basically start decaying, and you will see only the far field interactions, basically where only the local interactions between the different ions will dominate. Okay, so far away, really, it's just like if I just have my electrolyte alone, but very close, you should see an increase in the anodic species, right, in the negative species, right? You would see more over there. As a result of the fact that this is positively charged, you should see a depletion of the positive species. Okay, so ultimately, as I look far, far away, especially since I put those concentrations so that they will make the electrolyte electrically neutral, then these two should reach their final levels, right? C naught plus and C naught minus. Okay? So far away you will have that, and electrically, right, you're saying, well, electrically the charge in this thing, right, in as a position, as a function of position would be obviously the valence of those ions that you have in there, how many of them you got there, right, times the concentration, okay, for the positive species, right, like that, okay, minus, because now I have negative ions, okay, that's what you would expect to see. Okay, so this is the charge spatially distributed across the thing, and, well, you can think of this entire charge over here as being pinned. So technically speaking, right, this is again a function of position. Okay. So you should also have your pinned charges, the charges from the particles. Right. Gonna put that rho naught as, and these are pinned, right? These are particles that I seeded. Okay. So technically these charges, the spatially distributed ones where the concentration that I have imposed basically readapts, and you will have a concentration profile as you get close to that, will really impose what happens at that interface. Okay? Now, I had that slide summarizing this. They have many of these layers have their own already, have already their name. So you can see phi naught would be like the voltage associated to the charge. Okay? You won't have a stern layer, which be the ions immediately in contact with the surface. Then you can have, depending on the ordering that occurs, right, you have an inner Helmholtz layer and an outer Helmholtz layer of these ordered charges that form and accumulate on top. There's a lot of work done on this. This description that I'm giving you is very simplistic. What occurs at the interface of a battery is very complicated, but conceptually, you should expect to have something that is not neutral, right? A complicated phenomena controlling the migration of ions inside into the particle. Okay, at equilibrium, nothing effectively goes in and nothing effectively goes out. Okay, everything is quiet in that sense. Okay, now I want to start talking about the details on what happens there. Probably the most important thing is the length of that layer, okay, if at all, right? Clearly it's not the same to have one isolated particle or one isolated charged surface that when you have, for example, two particles that are very close to each other, okay, because obviously both of them will have their own superficial charge, okay, and in here, you could completely disrupt this ordering that develops as a result from the positive charge. So you basically will, all the positively charged ions in the gap between our particles will want to diffuse out, right? Because basically, these charges are repelling it. And at the same time, the negative ions will want to go here, completely altering the chemistry and the equilibrium at that interface. Okay? So in this case, we're not gonna be focusing on that situation or situations like that. Obviously, it's not the same if you have a spherical particle that if you have platelets, right? Different geometries will impose different interfacial conditions. So to a first approximation, we can assume that what occurs at this boundary, and by when people refer to the interface, we really refer to a much wider region, nanometers ahead of the actual interface, and nanometers inwards, there's a lot of action going on. And typically what we do is we say, we don't understand really what's occurring there. Okay, there's a lot, and actually it is not until these last couple of years that people actually started to look closely into what happens here and actually start describing with very complex methods, combining things like molecular dynamics, density functional theory to try to actually understand the structure of that interface. That is completely open, an open field for research right now. Conceptually, you should expect that the different charges that occur there are trying to balance themselves out to reach an equilibrium of the system. Now, just to give you an idea, and again, this is a very simplistic description of what occurs in the system, I want to use this description, very simple description that I built, to just give you an idea of the length scale of what occurs here. And to also to give you a sense that what actually occurs in this length scale, it's also chemistry dependent, that what occurs at the interface is completely chemistry dependent, completely electrical state dependent. And besides, well, in this case, I really didn't actually define a chemical reaction going on. But besides what occurs there, you have all sorts of other things, other side reactions, material depositing at the interface that shouldn't be depositing there. Sometimes, and well, actually, most of the time, simply by immersing your battery material in an electrolyte, that's enough so that a few milliseconds later, you already have a coating that developed there because these particles, the surfaces are so reactive. Okay. I will not disclose those specific details. I'm just going to talk about conceptually to give you a mental handle onto how to think about these interfaces and at least how classically has been thought about that in the very recent past. Okay. So, if I wanted to describe the electrical state of that interface, the first thing I would have to do is I would go, have to look at Coulomb's equation. Okay, in which case, what you have is that the dielectric constant times the, in this case, the Laplacian of the electrical field, right? That is the voltage gradient that develops as a result of that charge, or even these individual charges, right? They both specify a voltage gradient there, together with that concentration, because you can see, and I hope you can see, that if I have a charged surface, right? If I specify a voltage, right, associated to that surface, that will indeed specify positive ions basically moving out, okay, trying to get as far away as possible, and negative ions trying to match it, right? Defining with there a distance where that will happen, okay? So, in classic electrostatics, the equation tells us that that charges in general are sources of electric fields. Okay, in this case. And again, this is a very simple description. Okay, it's more complicated than this, right? Again, we're just taking the simplest description possible, and nothing is stopping me from grabbing this charge description, which is what I had over there, and plugging it in here. Okay, so I can go and put it in there. I'm gonna start simplifying some things. For example, I know that ENA, this is Avogadro's number, and that's the electronic charge, right? That basically is Faraday's constant. So I can just put it in there because that helps me some. C minus of X In this case, by x, we mean the, in this case, the vectorial position, right? The in three dimensions, the where this is, right? And minus. I'm sorry, this is a plus. C minus of x plus rho naught x, which is the charges that are pinned in space. Okay, and well, now what I need to do is find a relationship for C of x for both the positive and the negative charges. Okay, now something that I do know, okay, is that the electrical potential, okay, is related to the chemical potential at equilibrium. Via the concentration, right? We derive relationships like this. If you remember, we specified that at equilibrium, the potential of a material is related to the concentration, right? We define the electrochemical potential in that sense. So this is just a result of that, okay? And I can say this, I can specify this relationship for the positive ions and the negative ions, right? Where C naught would basically correspond to these initial concentrations that I specify. Okay, so from this relationship, then I can say that the actual concentration, okay, is going to be C naught okay, basically just defined an Arrhenius-type relationship that just results from balancing the electrical field in the system to its associated chemical potential. Okay, and I can say the same for the negative concentrations. Okay, all I've done is just specify a combined electrostatics with what I know of electrochemistry. Okay, and put them together, right, and see what happens. Okay, I'm going to erase my cartoon, but I hope you don't forget the mental picture. So all I'm going to do now is just directly substitute. Okay, and I get ZF C naught plus E to the CF, oh, sorry, phi over RT minus CF C naught minus E to the minus CF phi over RT plus the special pin charge. And I'm going to make an assumption here, impose an assumption, which is the electrolyte is neutral in the absence of those special charges. So I'm going to say that C plus naught is going to be equal to C minus naught. That is the initial concentration, basically, what I mixed in. Okay, so that the material is actually balanced. And then I can rewrite this as I'm going to call that just C naught. And if I do that, then I can take that factor and that factor and combine them, and I get E okay. If you resort to your first, maybe second year math, this over here is 2 times the hyperbolic sine okay. So I really didn't do much except that I just collected terms here. And I have this hyperbolic sign. And this would be the equation I would have to solve for. A little bit complicated considering that I have the second order derivatives are related to the field via a transcendental function, and I also have a source term over there. Okay, so people that are very much involved in this, some mathematicians can just look at it and say, yes, I can think of the specific solution in this case. And again, I'm emphasizing the fact that phi is a function of position. So really, you're trying to find a function that satisfies those conditions, where C naught being the initial uniformly distributed concentration of the system. Okay? And I don't want to solve the equation. All I want to do is to have a measure of the thickness of the interface. Okay? So, which is really my concern, right? All I want to know is point out that these dimensions are very small, right? And, what I'm going to do now is make an approximation. My biggest concern really is this function over here, the hyperbolic sign. What can I do with that one? My calculus teacher when I was in college used to say that when you see things like this, just like when the doctor basically hits you gently with a hammer on the knee, you should have almost like a gut reaction when you see something like that on what to do. Okay? The kind of things that you say, oh, this is very complicated. I don't want to deal with that. Let's do the humble thing and approximate it. Okay? So what would you do? What? Say that again? Yes, Taylor series expansion, absolutely. So we know, and if you don't know Taylor series expansion, it helps a lot also to plot these functions. Okay, something I found is that, have you ever plotted this? People call it the cinch function. Have you ever plotted that? Right? You never plotted it? No? Okay, you'll see what I'm talking about here with the Taylor series expansion. Sketch it over here. The hyperbolic sine function, if you plot it, if you haven't plotted, you should plot it. This is the kind of thing that you should do at least once. If I have sinh of x as a function of x is a function that goes linearly close to zero, and somewhere around one, it bends and goes something like that, and over here it goes and bends something like that. Okay? So why? Because of the exponential, right? You can think of it as this term for very large values of that parameter will blow up exponentially, and for very, very negative values, it will blow up negatively. Okay, so, but if I'm very, very close to the origin, I can think of that as just being a line. Okay, so that's the trick here, and I'm just gonna do that and get that to be equal to, if I approximate this whole thing by just the argument, then I get 2 times z f c naught. Then I have to pull out that z, and I have to pull out the f. I have phi, and I have rt plus rho naught. It's still complicated, but I can still do stuff with it. So I can group the z's and the f, so I get c squared f squared. Okay, and hey, this is much more manageable. Okay. In fact, let's look at it in one-dimensional form. Okay, the one-dimensional equation would basically be as I get away from the surface, right, from my charge surface, and I'm going to erase this bit. What happens with it? If I get away from it, this equation turns into, that turns into this, which we're more familiar with. Okay, and I can put the epsilon on the denominator, and I get 2 z squared f squared c naught over rt phi plus rho naught. Let's just pretend I can associate rho naught to the actual value of the voltage, so I'm going to ignore that one. Okay, and this gives me a second order differential equation where I'm looking for a function that if I derive it twice, I get the same function times a number. Okay? Which, if you don't remember that, it's something that looks like this. Okay? So, basically, we're talking about here an exponential, right? We're saying that the voltage in front of the charge of, sorry, of charge surface, yes. At equilibrium, of course, drops exponentially. Right, it's just, that's the exponential, right, out of that, okay? So, an exponential is the fastest decaying function of all of them. In fact, the only thing faster than exponential is the exponential of an exponential, okay? So this thing actually drops really fast, right? And how fast does it decay? Decays as fast as that number, right? This number over here is basically the inverse. Look at the units, right? This is voltage over distance squared. So that thing has to have 1 over distance squared. Okay? So the actual length of the interface, right, the thickness of where all the action is the square root of that thing over there, of the inverse of that. Okay, and again, I don't want to solve really the equation, although I kind of solve it to this point, okay, but I am interested on this thing. Okay? Notice what happens. The bigger the charge, okay, the smaller the profile of the concentration accumulation on the surface. Okay? The largest, the more solute I put on it, the more it's going to pile up. Okay? Interestingly enough, the higher the temperature, the more disorder, so the interface will become thicker. Okay, that boundary layer, right, will become thicker. Okay, but it will still decay exponentially. Okay, this number is called the Debye constant. And this number over here is called the Debye length. Again, I'm oversimplifying what occurs at this interface, okay? I'm just giving you here a rough idea in the simplest approximation, okay? But you get an idea of what happens, right? That really this interface is not just a flat, atomically sharp surface. There are all sorts of things going on that are temperature, concentration, and even geometry dependent, okay? So, we still need a handle, right? We still need a relationship to be able to describe the kinetics of insertion and deinsertion in the system. Okay, and this description by itself, all it does is gives you a qualitative handle of what's occurring there. We need something practical, right? Something that allows us to describe what happens there. So that's what I want to do next. Let's see how are we doing in time. I'm just going to set it up, okay? And then we're going to take a break and finish it up. Okay? So that's basically what we have over here. Okay? In this case, this is just the math that we just described. I think I'm off by a factor of 2 in what I wrote. Okay, but I have a Debye constant and a Debye layer, right? Basically, it's the same thing as what you have on the slides, okay? It's basically the same thing, okay? So, now I'm gonna redraw the sketch that I had on what happens in that barrier, okay? But now I'm gonna try to detail the energetics of what happens in it. Okay, I still have my particle. I'm going to draw it here. My particle, and I have in front of it some length, okay? And I want to find a practical relationship of stuff that it's intercalating, and I'm going to put stuff that goes in. I'm going to call it going forward, because it's intercalating, right? It's going into the particle, and stuff coming out, that's going backward. Okay? So, I'm gonna draw here my boundary between inside and outside, and I hope you agree with me that because of the charge, because of the change in medium, there has to be an energy barrier. There has to be some energetic wall I have to overcome in order to go from what I have outside to what I have inside. Okay, internally, you still have the lattice resistance, right? Once an atom gets inside, okay, it's rattling around the cage interstitial site, okay, or in its own vacancy spot, right? But at some point, that those vibrational changes will lead into a jump. So back in here, okay, I still have my energetic landscape is very periodic, okay, and this jump in here inside, I'm gonna call that DGF lattice LX. Okay, is the energy barrier I have to overcome inside here to go to jump from one lattice site to another lattice site. Okay, I hope you agree with that. Okay, from here you can start talking about the diffusion, right? Diffusion of lithium or whatever species you want to intercalate here. On that side I have a barrier. Well, if it's a liquid, right, basically it's barrierless, right? It's just diffusing through Brownian motion on this side. Okay? But up here and here in the middle, I would expect to have some sort of barrier. Okay, that I have to overcome, right? In fact, this barrier is what's keeping these atoms in here, right? I have to overcome that jump in order to jump outside, right? Think of it as, well, I don't know, this is the playground and the kids want to play outside, they have to open the door to leave the room, right? So this is delta G of reaction, right? That's how the energetics that has to be overcome. So if I apply a positive voltage, okay, keeping this as my reference, if I apply a positive voltage, I expect that this level should go up. Okay, and let me make the point, right? So goes up, so it goes up, now it looks like this. Okay, and what happens? Well, now as I make this distance from here to here smaller than from here to here, then thermally, basically they can, instead of jumping from here to here, they can also jump from here to here and then just lie down and go. Okay, so there's a jump here. Right, there's a potential there, eta. Think of it as, we are gonna call it the over potential, right? How much is the energetics you have to impose in order to allow for stuff to come out? Okay, so there's a, right, if the potential is positive, right? And the potential is negative, right, then they make it harder. Okay. So now this is okay. So you can think of it, right? That basically, I'm keeping this barrier fixed. What I'm doing is I'm moving this level with respect to my reference, so that if I change the sign, I make it really hard. Okay. And if at all, by doing that, I make it energetically more likely to come in here. So it'd rather come in here than actually keep going over there. Okay. Do you see that? So qualitatively, this is what I wrote down. Okay. Now the next trick is, how do I mathematically express this? Okay. So that I have a relationship that tells me when something goes forward or backward in the system. Keeping in mind that when eta equals zero, and I hope you agree with me on this one, that whatever comes out should be equal to whatever goes in. Okay. Or if you prefer, effectively, because equivalent to saying, no effective flux in or out in the absence of that over potential imposed on the system. Okay. We have everything at this point. We just need to write it mathematically, but I'm going to do that after the break. Okay. And we'll see you guys in 5 minutes. So what we're talking about here, practically speaking, is what it's known in the scientific literature as the Butler-Bomer relation. Okay? Given our physical picture of what should happen when stuff goes in and out, of the battery particle, we want to derive an interfacial kinetic relationship that will ultimately have that name, based on the on what should go in and go out, right? So think of it as, well, I want to account for the total charge per unit area per second that crosses that boundary. What does it depend on? Well, I should have a forward flux, basically what I gain, and I have to subtract a backward flux. I hope you agree with me that as this barrier is changing in size, as I apply my driving force, my electrical driving force, even if the barrier decreases, not only stuff can come out of on this side, but also stuff can still jump on this side. Okay? I should be able to account for that. So that when my driving force goes down to zero, okay, the stuff that comes out on this side, if it's still leaky, should be equal to the amount of coming in that comes in. There are other limitations, though, physically speaking. You agree with me that the stuff that comes here forward into the particle will depend on how much stuff I have on this side. So I have a concentration, let me call it CS, okay, what I have outside. You agree with me that if I have nothing outside, there will be no forward flux at all. Even if the drive, even if this potential is very, very low, okay, if there's no reactant, no stuff to come in here, the flux will be zero. So whatever I put in here, okay, whatever goes in there will depend on if there's stuff available here. If you have, of course, a diffusion limited system, okay, where basically this comes in here so fast that basically this is depleted, the reaction will stop too. Okay, do you see that? Okay, basically, there's no reactant, there's no forward flux. The same here. Well, when an ion reacts and jumps into the lattice, it not really jumps in the lattice, it jumps into a vacancy in the lattice. Okay, it's the equivalent of buying a ticket for the movie, right? I might have my ticket, okay, basically I can go forward into the specific theater, but if there's no seat for me to sit into, if there's no vacancy, if there's no interstitial, then I can't go in there. Okay? So I hope you agree with me that the higher the solubility limit, and we've been playing with that from the beginning, okay, the more vacancies I should have if my battery is doesn't have anything inside. Okay? So this spot over here that I'm graphically putting as the spot where it would jump, really, I'm saying that is the fraction of vacancies that I have there, right? So if in here the concentration matches the solubility limit, then I cannot put anything in there. So I want to go forward, I can't go in. Okay? So, or if you prefer, if I apply a voltage of the opposite polarity, nothing will come in this direction, okay? Because, well, there's nothing in here also either, right? If it's completely full or depleted, right? So I have to take into account both extremes, okay? I have to see what spots I have in here, and presumably, at least to a first approximation, right? And we're assuming here that there will always be always spots available, always vacancy. Okay? So my flux should account for that, okay? So I need to define a charge flux of stuff coming in and coming out that accounts for the amount of material on that side and stuff material on the other side. So for the forward flux, hope you agree that it's proportional of how much reactant I have in the electrolyte. Okay, so I'm going to put it here. It has to be proportional to the reactant. So if no reactant, nothing going forward. Right? You agree with that? Okay. So also, since this has units of moles per meter cube, I have to also multiply that by Faraday's constant on the valence to actually get the charge. Okay? So basically have converted that into coulombs, basically. Okay? And I need a rate of transfer. Okay? So I'm gonna put here my forward reaction. And since this one has units of charge per meter cubed now, then this one has to have units of meters per second, so that I have here coulombs per meter squared per second. Right? Do you see that? Okay. So this is my forward reaction rate. Okay? If the reaction is so, if this were not a rechargeable battery, if this were just a single-use battery, this term would be zero. Okay? Basically, I need that driving force. It's what drives the system. Okay? The rechargeable part is here. Okay? Because this is what drives the system to put things in and out. Okay, so I should have something here too. And in this case, since I want this to work also the other way, okay, I'm saying here that the backward flux is going to be proportional to how much stuff I have here, right? If my particle is completely empty, nothing should leave the particle because there's nothing there to leave. Okay? So it's in the same way, there should also be okay? That's just my relationship, right? I'm just defining forward and backward fluxes, stuff coming in and out. Okay? Now, notice that I have shifted all the attention to the reaction, forward reaction rate and backward reaction rate. That's all I've done at this point, right? Basically, take all my ignorance and put it into those constants that I don't know what they are. Okay? That's all I've done at this point. So I'm gonna say that my reaction, forward reaction rate should be the some thermal independent reaction rate, okay, e to the minus delta G forward, call it F or forward, over RT, okay? Somehow there's some energy barrier, right, that I have to overcome, okay, in order to go in or go out, okay? And by the same token, there's got to be a backward contribution. Some contribution, some rate that is temperature independent and it's field independent. Some barrier in the other direction, right? Barriers do not necessarily have to have the same height. Okay, so all I've done now is just define those two quantities, okay? Basically have put my ignorance into these two quantities and to these two quantities. Right now I'm just applying the divide and conquer approach, okay? So, well, what do I do with this? I'm going to say that the forward reaction, the energy of formation, right, the size of the barrier, as we have wrote over there, should be the actual energy barrier without any electrical contributions. Times some driving force. Okay, I'm just calling it eta for now. Okay? The same with the negative driving force. Okay? Just splitting out my contribution so that I have my, oops, sorry. I meant this one. Okay? Different Greek letter. Okay? I can just put them in there. Okay? Which all I'm done to this point is basically start, things that I can do, noticing that in the absence of driving forces, I would expect that these two would cancel out. So I'm going to say KF naught equals KB naught. This is also assuming that the rate at which things come in is going to be the same as the rate of things coming out in the absence of any driving forces. And I'm also going to say that in the absence of any driving forces, the energy barrier should be the same, right? Basically, I'm already trying to make it so that in the absence of anything, whatever comes in on this side goes on the other side, and nothing really actually goes in or out, okay? Or if you prefer, given a specific day, if students are coming in and out of this classroom, we always have a certain fix in the average number of students in the classroom. Okay? So that's basically the construction. Okay? And, now I need to substitute it in there. Okay, I'll put it in there. So J is going to be, I'm going to pull out C and F. I can also pull out K. I'm going to call this just K. In fact, I can call it KR for the overall reaction rate. I have that delta G factor that is common to both of them. So I can pull out a minus E to the minus delta G naught over RT. And then whatever I have in there is going to be the contributions from the driving forces. Okay? So I have E to the, oh, I'm sorry. I still have this prepending factor that are actually the important here. So E to the CF, the other one, that one, my squiggly symbol over RT for my forward reaction rate. For my background reaction rate. Okay? This doesn't quite look like what people would find in the books, but here's the next argument. I say that my driving force, which has to have units of potential, okay, is really my over potential, okay? Plus, oh, and I just made a mistake. I'll fix it in a second. Plus, the contributions, the chemical contributions from both what I have inside, think of it as the chemical potential differences between the what I have inside and what I have inside. So okay, basically the chemical potential contributions of both what is inside and outside, right? So basically, think of this. If I multiply the whole thing by CF, basically here I would have the electrochemical potential multiplied by the interfacial over potential and the chemical potential differences between the system. Now, I made a mistake here. I forgot to add something to that description. For the forward and backward Gibbs free energy contributions, the reaction itself has a certain efficiency, okay, meaning that I apply an electrochemical driving force, eta, in the system, okay, and I won't get the entire strength of it, okay, but it will be determined by the specific character of the interface by itself. So I'm going to put here a certain factor called alpha. I'm going to call this alpha forward, and here I'm going to put alpha backward, right, which means I'm completely missed here to drive alpha forward. And here I forgot to write alpha backwards. Okay, those play an important role later on. Okay, so now that I have that, I can take this description and then just substitute it on what my squiggly symbol is. Okay, and here I have that potential that I can just put in there. Notice that this eta basically replaces directly that previous symbol. Okay, and this RT over ZF is canceled by that ZF over RT. Okay? And the only difference is this natural log that actually, when I put it in there and multiply it by that term, this alpha that multiplies here really can enter here as an exponent. Okay? But since this is the exponential of a natural log, then this contribution, the exponential of the natural log, is basically what I have inside to that exponent. Okay? Do you see that? I really don't want to have to go through the whole math. I just want you to point out what the next step is, right? But if I substitute this term in here, okay, what I will get is that term will be canceled out. This alpha will enter the natural log as an exponent inside. And then the exponential or whatever I have here with that exponent to the natural log will give me just the argument to that exponent. Okay, so this term will prepend here to the alpha f and will also prepend, but flipped because of the minus sign, this other term on that side. Okay, so I go and put it there. Where I still have my Gibbs free energy formation of the reaction. Okay, and I have now Cs times that thing to the alpha f
but this is in the denominator, so this is CF to the minus alpha F, okay, times, I'm going to erase that bit so I can keep going there. Okay, E to the alpha F C F eta over RT, okay, that's my forward rate of reaction, okay, minus, I still have CT minus C, multiplying, in this case, this whole thing but flipped and with alpha B, so I have CT to the alpha B times CT minus C to the minus alpha B, E to the minus C F eta, I still have that, alpha B, let's put it in fact this way, alpha B alpha eta over RT, like that, okay? And I'm just going to collect terms. Okay, so now I have CS1 minus alpha F CT minus C to the alpha F I promise you this is as complicated as it's going to get. And I have these two, so I have now on this side CT minus C to the 1 minus alpha B CF to the alpha B. Notice that these two mirror each other. Okay? E to the minus alpha B CF eta over RT. Okay? And did I miss something? Well, this is that term, which I still have to multiply by CF KR e to the minus delta GF naught. Okay? I'm almost done. Okay? I want this flux to be zero. Okay? When my overpotential is zero. Okay? Which means, well, this goes to one, this term goes to one, so that means that the difference between this one and that one have to be zero. Okay? Which doesn't seem to be pretty obvious for arbitrary C's and arbitrary C's and this is supposed to be an S. Yeah, arbitrary concentrations outside and arbitrary concentrations inside. So, but it should happen. The only way I can do that is if this prefactor is equal to that prefactor and the condition turns out to be very simple. I'm going to write it here so that I can start talking about the implications from that function. Okay, is that if alpha F, the forward constant, another constant from the backward, another constant equals to 1, if I can do that, okay, then I can regroup these terms, okay, so that this one would be alpha B, and this one would be alpha F. And notice that it's the same prefactor now. Okay? What this is telling you, this is really giving you the strength of the reaction. It's telling you that if my forward reaction is very high, it's going to want to react into the particle really fast with a lot of strength, right? Because the potential contribution is going to be very large. But if I try to discharge it, it's going to be very weak. Okay? But in this case, since we're imposing that in the absence of any driving force, there shouldn't be any flux, then it's the only way to make that relationship work. Okay, now if I do that, then I get that my flux inside the particle is going to be and now I can actually factor out the whole thing. I get CS alpha B alpha F and I get e to the alpha f this relationship. And relationships like this one
that can you can derive having an idea what occurs at the interface are the typically what people use to describe the intercalation in batteries, right? And I'm going to put here a BV to make the point that this is what people refer to as the Butler-Bohmer relationship. Okay? And notice what happens if I don't have stuff outside or if I have completely reached the solubility limit, the reaction is going to completely stop as we were expecting. Okay? Typically, I'm going to put here and then just put an approximated approximation. Typically, it's really hard or people don't know a priori what the interfacial reaction alpha F and alpha B are going to be. So typically, and this is what you want in a good battery, you want you want it to be equal to 1/2, right? You basically want to be able to put things inside as fast as you can take them out, right? That makes it a pretty darn good battery, right? I guess in some cases, especially if you care about, if you don't care much about power density, but you care a lot about energy density, you really don't care much that this number is very high, but you will care a lot of this number to be large, right? Maybe you want to take a long time to, you want to take your time to discharge it, but you want to recharge it really fast, so man, you really want that number to be big because you want to put things there as fast as possible. Right? It's a little bit more complicated because the faster I take things off the electrolyte into the particle, okay, the more the easier it is to deplete the electrolyte. Right? In the same way, if I put things really fast into the electrolyte, okay, I can also generate another phase by dumping so much outside. So it's a little bit more complicated than just that. But in that case, for the case of alpha F equals to alpha B equals to 1/2, then I can rewrite this expression as notice that when alpha F equals alpha B equals 1/2, this basically becomes another hyperbolic sign again. So I can put a 2 over here, and I can say again, right, say hi again to my friend the hyperbolic sign. And this is just another way of writing the same thing for one specific case. Okay? The interfacial reaction. This is the bit that was missing, right? We put all our ignorance on how that reaction in a battery proceeds, okay, by defining a reaction front, right, the quantity X of R, if you remember. Then for the case of a thin film, we pinned it, right, and still ignored it. And you can see that in the most extreme of cases, especially when our potentials are high, you cannot ignore it. Okay? Not only that, the interfacial boundary condition is not constant. It's a function of what you have inside and outside. Okay? It depends exponentially on the interfacial over potential. So, how much material reacts in the front, you expect to be different from how material reacts in the back. Because if in the back it's electrically shielded, this number is going to be fixed, even if you have stuff in there, outside and inside, nothing will go in and out. Okay, and by the same token, right, if you don't have lithium in the electrolyte and constant and vacancies inside the particle, right, also nothing will go in or out. Okay, they both matter. Okay, so that's the relationship. Let's see how. Oh, I still have 10 minutes. So, and this is just the slide version of the same thing. Okay. This quantity over here, this one over here, typically this is referred to as the exchange constant, and even though they put a knot there to make it a constant, it's not really a constant, as you can see. It's going to be position dependent. It's going to depend where in the surface you are. Clearly, you should expect that reaction rate is going to depend on the chemistry of that specific interface. It's not going to be the same of a graphite plate when it's, say, its basal plane facing the electrolyte than the orthogonal surfaces looking at the electrolyte, right? That's already known, right? People are working a lot about that and trying to characterize that and quantify that better. Okay? And, it'll depend on what's occurring inside and outside. And it'll depend, of course, on the temperature. Okay? And will depend, of course, for very low temperatures, this reaction is gonna become sluggish. Okay? And, on how large that potential is also locally. Okay? Any questions on this point? Okay, it's a lot to take in one shot. I mean, everything here basically couples the losses that we have already discussed of diffusion in the electrolyte to the accumulation in the particle, right? This is the glue that puts all the phases together. And as you can see, it's not an easy glue to handle, right? It's a nonlinear function that has this polynomial type relationship, right? I'm actually For that case, I should have put here 1/2. Okay, so it's not trivial, right? It becomes quite messy, right? What occurs there, and not only that, it's very sensitive to our potential. So if that ratio is much larger than 1, okay, then things will become very nonlinear. Okay? Basically, charge will be put in or put out at exponential rates for very large overpotential. So very high C rates, the material really wants to return back to equilibrium, so it just puts as much as it can, as fast as it can, and it does it exponentially. The same when you recharge. Okay? And that is a problem. Okay? Well, that's the exchange constant, and typically people write it like that, as you see on the board. That's the relationship. That's the last bit to start putting things together. What I did is to try to plot this function, basically the contribution of this part, ignoring that one, assuming this one was a constant, and assuming that one was a constant. So what you have over there is basically taking this part and put it in the denominator, and taking that part and put it in the denominator. So what you have here is that contribution alone. Okay? It has a very interesting properties, because if you think about it, this is the power that you're driving your particle with. Okay? Again, has units of charge per meter squared per second, right? So this is how much charge you're putting into the particle. Okay? As a function of concentration of voltage. So if I ignore the voltage part, just the concentration part. And that's the part I want to emphasize right now as a last bit before we go through all the other properties of this thing on Monday. I'm sorry, on Tuesday. Notice that this bit alone is zero when CS is zero, and is zero when CSCT. So I'm going to assume here this is basically JBB as a function of C, and I'm assuming that basically CS and C are roughly the same. So I'm going to put here CT over here, and this over here is zero. Okay? So you should expect that when it's completely empty, it's zero, and when it's completely full, the reaction is zero. When would you have the highest power for that particle? Giving the fact that this has units of coulombs per meter square per second. Would you have the highest power here? Clearly not here. As it turns out, you will get the highest performance of one specific particle at half the solubility limit. Okay, this is let's just say this is the cathode, right? You know that the solubility limit of the anode is higher than on the cathode, right? We've discussed this, right? Graphite has much larger solubility limit than any of the cathode compounds. So this is the cathode. This will be the anode. highest power occurs here. I don't know if you see the sign problem there. I cannot make my particles to deliver me both of them, the cathode and the anode, the same power, the same current density, maximum peak current density, given a fixed voltage, okay, at the same time. When one peaks, okay, the other one hasn't reached the whole way up. Okay, and of course, you can control the particles so that the effective amount of mass, basically, that you reach this point at the same time the anode is reaching that point. You can do that. Okay, you can certainly do that. But then you're not only engineering for the equilibrium properties, right, for the amount of charge that you can put in every particle. Now you also have to engineer for the reaction rates. And then you would care about what the reaction constant is inside, on the surface of the anode particles and the surface of the cathode particles. Cathode particles that react faster than anode particles will basically reach this point sooner, okay? And it will make, basically, by the time these particles are coming down in a discharge and these are basically just dumping as fast as possible, this won't be able to keep up, so you will have a lot of lithium accumulation in the electrolyte. Okay, you want these two to balance each other during the discharge process. Otherwise, you will start having other reactions during the system, including all the different failure mechanisms that we will talk about once we have all these elements in place. Okay? Do you see that? Okay. Any questions? No questions. Okay. I'll talk more about implications on the next class. Okay. But I'm going to leave here. Basically, I'm going to start right here, right, and talk about all the implications from its functional form, from the point of view of design, from the point of view of reliability, because this is basically what controls the power contribution of the battery. The energy contribution, we know what controls it, right? The thermodynamics of the battery, right, the solubility limits and the energy densities, equilibrium energy densities, is what controls that part. The power is controlled by how fast I can put it in and out, given a local over potential for each of the particles. And if you have a thin film, you can see that I will be getting more power here than if I have a fully charged, discharged battery or a fully recharged battery. Clearly, you don't want to completely deplete your battery, because if you go all the way here, basically nothing, based on this model, right, nothing will go in here because being completely empty, there's really nothing there to do overall, right? You have to be slightly over, right, in order to start to be able to dump things in, okay? Anyway, we'll discuss that on Tuesday. We'll have a nice rest of the week. Thank you.